Thank you, Cheryl. I'm hoping I got that right, pronounced that right. Cheryl. Great. Yay. So yeah, good evening. We are working our way at the moment through the yamas and niyamas, through the first two limbs of yoga. Hi, Kathy. Some of them are mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, which is what we have been working through more broadly. And the one we're looking at tonight is called Santosha, and it intentment. So it's a really, really nice one. So before we start, or to start, we're just going to have a consecration of our time together, which is offering up our time to the service of others. So just closing the eyes, really just to kind of let go of the thoughts and move into the heart space. And just relaxing wherever we are. And then coming to our breath. So just observing the breath or being with the breath. And then following this breath down into the heart center. And from here, just making our consecration. So whatever words come to you, just offering to share our time together this evening, let it be for the service of others. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be at peace. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. I'm going to take a deep inhale and exhale and open the eyes. So as Kathy says, yes, this week looking at contentment is probably better than last week looking at purification, where there are all sorts of horrible things that we do to our bodies to help them purify in yoga. Or horrible, I suppose it depends how you look at it. So yes, none of that this week, although, as we'll look at later, the practice of contentment really is a purification in itself. And all the yamas and niyamas are a purification, as are the limbs of yoga. So yeah, this week we're getting going with Santosha. I'm just going to type that in to the room. San, S-A-N, means completely or entirely. And then Tosha, T-O-S-H-A, means acceptance and contentment. So this niyama is the practice of complete contentment, complete contentment, complete acceptance. And we can sort of get a bit confused about acceptance on the spiritual path. So I just wanted to talk about acceptance, what it is and what it isn't. So sort of in the early stages of a spiritual journey, I suppose, we can have this feeling that acceptance is almost like a spin on something. I'm having a god-awful day, I'm just going to accept it. And that can sort of be confusing and also not very helpful, because it's like you're sort of suppressing what's really going on. And, you know, the whole, like, oh, turn that frown upside down, put a happy spin on it, you know, my cat got run over. But on the positive side, I'm no longer going to be buying cat food, or now my boyfriend can come over and, because, you know, he has allergies to cats. So that's a good thing about the cat dying. Like, that kind of thing, as acceptance, is really not what Santosha is about. That's not really acceptance. That's good marketing, I suppose. I don't know what else you'd call it. But it's like a whole kind of spin. So, and not very authentic. And authentic is a word that's also overused, I think, personally, in spiritual circles. But really, it's like an authentic acceptance. Santosha, and what does that mean? What does that mean, authentic acceptance? And I kind of like to look at it as being about uncovering the stories, uncovering what is really there, like taking a deep, deep look. So, for example, like authentic acceptance. So, for example, if we're really sad about something, I'm trying to think. So, say we're really angry about climate change, for example. And we could just say, oh, I'm just going to accept it. I'm going to accept it. I'm going to, you know, turn that frown upside down. And instead of being angry about climate change, I'm going to say, woohoo, isn't this brilliant? Because now I get warmer winters. And that's my positive spin on it. And that's my way of accepting it. But if you do that, like you don't really learn about yourself. You don't uncover the stories that you've put on it or what's really lying beneath. So when you start to dig a bit deeper, you might uncover that the anger you feel about pollution is really because you have a deep love for trees, you know, for example, for the environment, for nature. And you know, if you're, you know, as I mentioned, like maybe your cat got run over or something, instead of saying, well, I'm accepting it, my cat's gone, I'm going to miss him, but you know, on the positive side, this is now what's going to happen. Or even just sort of being, I'm accepting it and trying to move on. You're not really sort of learning anything about yourself and what grief is and the process of grief. And what you realize from when you start to get under grief is that there is a love there. So you start to see this sort of common theme coming up, that when you start to scrape away at some of the things you're very upset at, rather than accepting them, but scraping away at them, you begin to find under it all that there is love there. So if very much Santosha is not about forgetting the bad and replacing it with positive thoughts. And sometimes that can be helpful. If you are prone to seeing the negative, it's helpful to try and replace with positive. But it's rather sort of, you know, as the Course in Miracles says, like, we are never upset for the reason we think we are. Trying to understand why we're not accepting what is. Why do we keep coming back to this feeling of dis-ease about certain things in our lives? Why are we triggered over and over again? What is it we're not accepting, and why is that? And then underlying that, what is there? So one of the things I often think about when looking at Santosha is the work of Byron Katie, called The Work, where, you know, she asks this series of questions about everything that's upsetting to you, and to try and sort of unpack your story and get you to really what's going on deep inside. And that's her questioning of, you know, is it true? Can I absolutely know that it's true? Who would I be without this thought? Are we really unhappy? Are we really trapped? Are we really all these stories that we've created for ourselves in our lives? And I know we've talked about before, you know, being the monkey that is outside the cage, that sees a banana inside the cage, puts its hand into the cage, grabs the banana, and then cannot get its fist out because it's holding the banana, but it's free. At any time it could let go of the banana and run away, but it doesn't. And like, is that what's happening to us? Are these stories, you know, just you know, unhelpful to us? Can we let them go? Why aren't we letting them go? That kind of thing. And I remember watching one of the processes that Byron Katie did with someone in an audience. And it was a similar thing to the climate change. The woman came up and she just said, you know, how depressed she was in life, that she felt so depressed all the time because of what everyone's doing to the polar bears. And she was really upset. And I sort of felt for her because, you know, sometimes if I can get into that spiral with orangutans, that's my trigger. When I start to hear about the orangutans in the forest and the palm oil, I can really start to get into this whole, I cannot believe what corporations are doing, palm oil, that kind of, you know, down the rabbit hole. And so she talked about this with her and did this whole, you know, is it true? You know, what are you feeling? And she got to this crux of it, that the woman realized that she was just extremely caring and really, really loved polar bears. And so as a result of this, their mood was one of acceptance, and not acceptance that terrible things happened to polar bears, but acceptance that her anger was something that was just sort of covering up her love, and that anger was stopping her from doing something which was, you know, maybe having a fundraiser to raise money to bring more awareness to the plight of the polar bears, or even just to get herself out there to help save them, or changing the course of her whole life to go do that. And what was happening was that the mind was just getting far too involved, and she sort of entered this battle of, why can't I just accept that the polar bears, you know, this is happening, why can't I just accept it? And that's something that we often do in a spiritual path. We can, because we hear acceptance is very big, certainly in the Eastern traditions, acceptance is huge. Like Buddhism is all about, not all about, but Buddhism has contained within it this element of acceptance. The Tao Te Ching is absolutely, and we'll talk about that in a minute, and yoga is, tradition of yoga is too, and Hinduism, this acceptance. We say sometimes we can go astray with when we're looking at acceptance, because we just kind of want to get rid of what's happening instead of getting to the root what's happening and then working from acceptance from that. And as I said, like, it doesn't mean that we're not caring. In fact, it's quite the opposite. What can happen is when you start to have acceptance is that you become a force in the world, because the love that's underlying it sort of comes through and pushes you on, or at least helps you be like a very sort of safe space for others to express themselves in. So when I think about acceptance, it's really the Tao Te Ching that I think about. Like, I feel like a lot of the book of the Tao Te Ching is really just accepting what is, just being with what is. It talks a lot about the pendulum swinging from side to side, and sort of just allowing it to come into one place. If you push too hard one way, it swings the other. And we're going to talk about the Tao Te Ching, and I'm looking forward to going through that book in probably just a few weeks. And Byron Katie has a book. I'm just going to read some of what she says. It's called 1,000 Names for Joy, and it's with Stephen Mitchell, who I think is her husband, who does a wonderful translation of the Tao Te Ching. So she takes part of the down and then talks about it. She says this. So the world is, this is the part of the Tao, the world is sacred. It can't be improved. If you tamper with it, you'll ruin it. If you treat it like an object, you'll lose it. And I feel like this is really like the essence of the Tao. When you realize that there is nothing lacking, the whole world belongs to you, is another one of the verses of the Tao. And true mastery can be gained by letting things go their own way. So it's all very much about sort of just leaving things. And she says this in her sort of commentary around this verse that the world is sacred. The world is perfect. As you question your mind, this becomes more and more obvious. Mind changes, and as a result, the world changes. A clear mind heals everything that needs to be healed. It can never be fooled into believing that there is one speck out of order. So some people take the inside perfect and make it into a concept, so they then conclude that there's no need to get involved in social action or anything. But that, she says, is separation. Because if someone came to you and said, I'm suffering, please help me, you wouldn't answer, well, you're perfect, just the way you are. Accept yourself. You would naturally respond to the person in need. And she says, realization has no value until it's... I would travel to the ends of the earth, she says, for the sake of one person who's suffering. The desperate, the hopeless are the unenlightened cells of my own body. And would I let myself die in an imagined tortured chamber? My God, instead I think there's someone out there who really believes that there is a problem. And I remember when I used to think there was a problem, how could I say no? Rather I say yes. What a privilege. It's more than that. It's self-love. People are perfect just the way they are, however deeply they're suffering, but they just don't realize that yet. So when I meet someone who's suffering, I don't say, oh, there's no problem, everything is perfect. You know, we don't do this whole, oh, I'll just accept what is, and yes, this is, you know, and move on. It's about sort of understanding that there isn't a problem. But if you're not there with yourself, then yes, it's the authentic acceptance of realizing I'm suffering. I'm suffering right now. I'm believing something that isn't there. Let me take a closer look. But I can just accept that I'm in grief, you know, rather than just, you know, trying to spin it on my cat got run over and that's fine. You can just be, I'm acceptance of what is arising right now for me, and that is grief. And then when you're ready, you can sort of do the dive of why is there grief? Because I love my cat. And so then you sit in love, and then you sit in that space of love, and maybe it's painful or maybe it's freeing, but it is what it is. So there's a real beauty in this sort of authentic, you know, authentic acceptance of being really honest about where we are, and then working with that as a means to sort of engage in acceptance, even if it's just accepting that we're not accepting, you know. So she mentions about, you know, everywhere, every thought I used to, that used to look like a poisonous snake to me, she says, is now a rope. And I can stand over that rope for 1,000 years and never be frightened of it again. Whereas everyone in the world might come up on that rope and run screaming the other way, I wouldn't be afraid for them or feel sorry for them or worry about them because I know they're not in danger. I only see a rope, but I would want to help people with that rope. So, yeah, acceptance is most definitely not just sort of sitting around and being passive. And my personal interpretation of Santosha is far more than just emotional acceptance or allowing, which kind of does imply a passiveness to it in some degree. So we talked about this a little bit last week, that the, if we think about the yamas and niyamas as a garden, I think about the yamas sort of as uprooting things that need to be let go of out in the world. And then niyamas are like the cultivation period, where we start planting seeds and then nurturing things. And so this is how I see, you know, why I see Santosha as being more of an active cultivation type strategy is the wrong word, but practice, I suppose. And that's because it falls within the niyamas, which all tend to be this sort of, this is what we're doing now to our soul. This, you know, so we had purification, we're like releasing, like adding things to the soil to help them grow, to help grow our seeds. And then this week was like planting seeds of contentment. Next week it's about willpower. It's really trying to grow your own willpower. And then it's self-study, and then it's surrender. So they're all sort of very active practices of, like, as I say, cultivating this garden. So, as I say, when I think about Santosha, I think it's a step beyond just acceptance. And as you know, as much as I love the Tao, I think the Tao gets to the beyond acceptance as well, but sometimes superficially it can be taken as just about acceptance. But I think both Santosha and the Tao, but particularly Santosha, are about something more. And it's really about sort of cultivating this idea of contentment. And how do you do that? How do you cultivate contentment? And I feel like it's a very gradual process. And part of that is a letting down of the guard, letting down of your own guard. And that's kind of like a purification in itself. So one thing I didn't mention last week when we were talking about purification was the very gradualness of that. Now, some people like Byron Katie just have an amazing awakening where it just, you know, she woke up one morning, I think, or had an overnight dark night of the soul kind of experience and then just woke up, like Eckhart Tolle did too. But for most of us, it's a very sort of gradual process, and therefore the purification process is also very gradual too. We sort of come down a layer and then we discover there's something else going on. So I was thinking about this week, I'm doing a lot of like physical body detoxing at the moment. You know, I've done pretty well on my liver. I can tell that things are sort of starting to balance out in my liver. And then all of a sudden, I've got issues with my spleen, so I'm told. So I was like, okay, I've got down that layer, and now Yeah, I'm back to my spleen, and Kathy's just asked me how's my meat eating going. I've eased off it a bit this week, just because I've now got like digestive issues have gone on from detoxing my liver, and I'm told constantly by the people who are helping me through this that this is what purification is, that it is a layered process, and obviously every individual is different. Some people stop eating grain and then just feel great forever and all their skin issues clear up and off they go and they're off to the races. But for some people, and Kathy says she's rooted for me, thank you. For some people, it can be very different. It can be, as I say, like a layered effect. So, you know, you start to clean up one part of your body and then another part reveals itself that was hidden before, as needing a bit of a clean up too, and off you go. And that's the same as the emotional and mental body, the whole, you know, sort of subtle body too. I mean, for me, they're one and the same. I view them as the same. So when I say, you know, issues with the liver that then arises in the spleen, I kind of mean issues with anger, and now that's arising in frustration or something, you know, whatever those two represent, like control issues, I think is the spleen. And that's kind of how I see this letting down of the guard for contentment to build. That there is a real gradual quality to cultivating contentment. It's not like you can just wake up and say, "Oh my God, I'm going to be content with everything today." It's like it's a very gentle process. So we can't just expect results overnight. And Deborah Dele, who, you know, I've been talking about, has this book, The Yamas and Niyamas, has this great. She talks about this in Santosha. She says, there is a Chinese proverb which states, people in the West are always getting ready to live, which I think sort of hits the nail on the head sometimes, that we just can't wait. She says, when we're little, we can't wait to be big. And when we're big, we can't wait to get out of the house. And then we can't wait to get through college and get a job. And we can't wait to have vacations. And we can't wait till retirement. And we're just always like thinking about, oh my God, when's it going to happen? And we can be the same with our spiritual journey. We can be very much like, oh, when I do this, this will happen. And when I do this, this will happen. And then one day I'm going to be absolutely clear and I'll be awakened and I'm just going to follow this pathway and off we go. But I say it's like we're so focused on the goal that the whole point of contentment is in the journey, is in the every single moment. So it's a very gradual, and we can't expect ourselves to be content in every moment. It just becomes like a gradual process. But, however, there are things I think you can do to work with that, to begin to cultivate that, to sort of purify and allow contentment to come through. And one of those is recognizing everything as sacred. So as the Tao says, the world is sacred. It can't be improved. Like, it is enough. The world is completely enough and is sacred. And just sort of understanding that in every moment, or trying to remember it three times a day is a start. So when things arise you know, we're unhappy with it, we can just remind ourselves that even this is holy, even this is holy. And I had kind of this little mini vision this week about holiness. So some of the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita I've referred to before as being like about the crystal ball. So there is the unmanifest, the purest of form, which is one level of God, one level of Brahma. It's a purity, but it's not even purity, because purity would imply there's an opposite. So you know where I'm going. There's this unmanifest, and then everything else is within this ball, which I call the crystal ball. So anything manifests, and it's not just the physical, it's things like, you know, angels and spirits, thoughts and emotions. They are manifest in the manifest world, and they're within this crystal ball. But what we don't often remember is that everything in the crystal ball, everything that is manifest, so that is every single thing your mind can think of now and in the future, comes from originally this unmanifest through a creative process that I don't, I can't say I know. So, but that's what is taught in the Bhagavad Gita, that it comes through this creative process into the manifest world. So everything that is manifest is from divine light. or from the unmanifest, or from love, or from purity, or from whatever it is you want to call it, because it has no word. So everything in manifestation is holy. And recognizing that is often very hard, but everything we lay our eyes on is holy, because it comes from this source of holiness. And even the most horrific thing in the world is manifest. So therefore, it came from the unmanifest at some point. And therefore, it is holy. And so when we start to recognize things as holy, and start to look around us in the day, and even in the times when terrible things happen on the news or to us, to just have this glimmer of remembrance that even this is holy, and I'm feeling this way, and even my feelings about it are holy, and even if I'm angry, that is holy, and all of that, it's all holy. To me, there is this real like play between the words holy and whole, with a W-H-O-L-E, that in when we begin to recognize that everything is holy, it's like we begin to make ourselves whole again. Or if you prefer like a different play on words, like you're beginning to fill in the holes. There's so many beautiful things you could do. The other day I was getting caught on the sun and the air and the, you know, oxygen. So, and then the sun as in S-O-N and air, H-E-I-R. I mean, it's just so many lovely plays on words you can have when you're thinking about sort of understanding or getting to, you know, working out in your mind, or how the stories unravel for you, and they unravel for me in these plays on words. So I was thinking about this and this sort of becoming whole again, and it's certainly how the shamanic path is actually used in soul retrieval, of becoming whole again. You, these parts of yourself that you throw away and the parts of the world that you throw away as thinking they aren't unholy, you bring them back in. And this to me is like a level of sort of active acceptance of when you start to sort of view the world rather than just going, okay, I'm just going to sit here and accept it. You start to say, okay, I'm actually going to practice the remembrance that everything is holy. And while that might not be authentic for me right now, like intellectually I can kind of grasp it, and so let me see if I can experience it. So can I experience this moment as holy, even if it's not? And that's maybe no, who knows? But over time, that could be like a practice of santosha, of this making yourself whole, or as I say, finding the holiness and stuff, or seeking to experience the holiness. And within that, there comes a contentment, because there comes an acceptance rather than a pushing away of what is. So that will be one way of looking at sort of actively practicing santosha. The other is a practice of gratitude. And I feel like this is like done to death a lot in the spiritual community. We talk so much about, oh, it's gratitude again. But it really is such a lovely, lovely practice. So, and it does help breed contentment. It does when you, and it's kind of like tied into the sacredness, because when you practice gratitude, what you're really doing is recognizing the gift in every moment. So everyone has ways to approach gratitude, and some are just writing down every night, you know, 10 things you're grateful for about your day, or if there's someone who drove you mad, then you could begin to like write down 10 things that are wonderful about that person, that are a gift about that person. And while it's done in hindsight, you know, time doesn't really exist, so it's okay. And so you're healing that moment that happened before, and the next time you're preparing yourself. So in that moment, you'll start to have these memories of, oh, okay, I can find the gift in this moment, because there is one. And again, it's not about putting a spin on it. It's not about marketing. It's about remembering the truth and understanding, you know, I'm not upset for the reasons I think I am. And that underneath all this, there is something. And if I haven't got time to quite get to it right now, then at least let me practice some gratitude or recognize the holiness. Excuse me, having a sip of tea. Another practice is cultivating wonder. And I talk about this all the time, this idea of of trying to be like the child and remembering how you felt as a child, where everything was sort of brand fresh and new. And I often think, because, you know, obviously the Bhagavad Gita talks about reincarnation, and I have no idea how it works, and but I was thinking, okay, so if you took a theory that we're reincarnated and you could get back to the first ever life that you had, I don't think it works like that, but if you could get back to that place, like, how would your eyes have looked upon the world? Like, free from, absolutely free from karma. Ultimately, I guess that's where we're going back to. Can't remember yesterday, so it's Kathy. So, right. Sometimes we have sort of glimpses of the deep, deep past, especially as we get older. I know my grandma remembers things that happened like 80 years ago, but she can't remember things she said 5 minutes ago. So maybe as we get older, we'll remember past lives and the very first life we ever had, where we had this sort of view of wonder. Anyway, I have no idea if that's how it works. I suspect not. But this sort of way of looking at the world through newness, and even just when you start drilling down into how the body works, or what it takes to publish a book, and all the people that are involved in making one book that you're reading, like all the people who, you know, the paper it was involved in, and the design, and then the transport, and throughout the logistics process of, I mean, it's thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And even when you start to think about that, there you can't help but start to be in sort of wonderment, because you think, goodness, how interconnected we are. Or whether you're exploring nature, and obviously nature's a very easy one for a lot of people to when they're in nature, they return to this sense of wonder of the world. Or you look up in the sky at night, or you're inspired by a movie. I mean, there are lots of things, art, those kinds of things where we start to wonder. So that would be, in my mind, another way of getting in touch with Santosha, of returning, sort of having a practice of contentment. Because when we, you know, obviously, if you're living in wonder, then that's a beautiful place to be. It's a place where the mind is open rather than judging. It's a place where the mind's in kind of a what the, you know, how the, what, which is it's really, you can't help but be contented if you're in that place, or you're certainly not in judgment, or pushing something away, or having sort of negative or overly positive thoughts about it. You're sort of in a balance of questioning. So that would be another practice. Let's see what I have here. So yeah, this is where it really starts to get interesting in my mind about Santosha. So when you start to do these things, these active practices, what I believe you're doing is you're allowing love to take you over a little bit. So while we're calling them active practices, what, you know, whether you're, you know, thinking about the sacredness in every moment, cultivating gratitude, thinking about being grateful or wonder, while there is an active thing happening from you, in my mind, yeah, and Kathy mentioned surrender, it's like you're allowing love to come through you in those moments. You're allowing love to take over you. And what I compare this to is the idea of falling in love with a person. And so Santosha for me really becomes about, it sort of moves through this allowing and acceptance into being a practice of falling in love. And I wanted to talk about this because I think it's worth like doing a deep dive on the time in your life that you fell in love, and trying to sort of explore what that did to you, how you reacted in the world in that state, how you think you got there, and what got you out of it, and whether you could bring it back, and all that kind of thing. So what exactly was that feeling, and how does it differ to other states that you've been in? I did this. I sort of went through this process of thinking about the whole falling in love. And what I sort of came out of it was that, you know, in the moment of falling in love, or when we're in that process, we are completely content. I mean, I just can't think of anything. That's where we are. Because I don't know about you, but I imagine we're all the same in this regard. But when you are in the midst of falling in love with someone, when you're in that process of falling in love, you could lose your job and not give a hoot. Like, you could go, oh, God, it really sucks. But anyway, whatever, because I feel great because I'm falling in love. And maybe that wouldn't work. But the edge is off. There is this contentment that comes from being in a state of falling in love. Or you could hear the saddest story. And I guess this is how Byron Katie feels. You could hear the saddest story. And through your tears, you would be honestly very sorry for the other person and what's happened, and you would say, you know, this is so, so sad and I want to help, but you retain this feeling of being in love. Like, that doesn't go, you know, when you're in love and your friends break up and you're like, oh God, that's really awful for you, but you don't get involved in it. The mind doesn't sort of step in. It's just you're still in love, and as a result of that, you stay very centered. So there's a real centering to being in the midst of falling in love. And it's kind of a little bit, it's giggly, but it's not without compassion for other people, for sure. It's not like, oh, well, I'm in love, stuff you all. It's not like that when you really are in love. Because actually what tends to happen when you fall in love is that you have more, you know, you want others to fall in love too. Have you ever had that, you know, in the midst of falling in love, and then you start looking around your friends and going, oh, maybe I could get them together and them together, because you want other people to feel this love too. Like, you want to share it. You want others to experience it. So you sort of begin to understand that the mind creates the upset, and that it's this falling in love, this love, that kind of switches the heart into overriding the mind, so that you stay in the heart that is very, very centering. So how do you fall in love, like, all the time? Is that possible? How do you generate this feeling of love, being in love all the time? And so this is sort of my take on it, but and this may change, and maybe you'll have a different take on it. But we often think, or I know I thought that that falling in love just happens to you. Just one day it just happens to you, and that's that. It's normally unexpected. It just kind of happens. And I also felt like you had to have an object or a person to fall in love with, that there had to be someone on the other side of that. But I had this experience where that was not the case. And I've talked about this before, but I'll just sort of mention this story again, where I was studying yoga for a month in Thailand, and I was cycling on my way to the studio one morning, and it was a really lovely morning, and I'd had, you know, a lovely croissant or something, and had great chocolate croissants for some reason in the place I was in Thailand. I was cycling to the studio, and I just felt this very familiar feeling come over me, and I felt very light and open heart, and really lovely and glowing, and, like, you know, I hate to say it, but almost like a bit joyful and a little bit blissful. And the reason I say I hate to say it is because it's such a rare feeling that I don't know if that was joy, but it felt very, very light. And I thought, God, I know this feeling. I kind of recognize it. Where have I had it before? And then I realized, oh my God, I've had this before when I've been in love. I'm in love. I'm in love. And I carried on cycling and was like, oh my God, I'm in love. I'm in love. Who am I in love with? Who am I in love with? Because I'd, you know, been there 3 weeks or so, and I wasn't really on the lookout. I was single, but I wasn't looking out for anyone. And then briefly, I kind of, am I in love with that guy? What about that teacher? Is that what it is? Am I in love with this teacher? And then I realized that there was nothing. There was no one on the end of that. There was just this state of being in love that I had not had before, without someone being on the end of it. And it was such a gift for me. And I don't know if it was just grace, but it was a real gift, because it made me realize that it's a natural state for us. And it doesn't require someone on the end of it. It's something that can be there. We can be constantly in a state of falling in love. And it lasted about a minute, and then it went. And I was like, wow, that was amazing. I'd love some more of that. And I kind of went through in my head, like, well, how did I get to that? What happened? And, you know, I say maybe it was grace, maybe it was the croissant, maybe it was, you know, being off work for 3 weeks and just being in a state of having my mind a little softer and more gentle with myself, and then being, you know, in a place where I was doing a lot of spiritual study and practice. More anything like yoga is the practice, less of the study. I don't know. But it certainly gave me faith that falling in love, this having this sense of falling in love, is something that can be a natural state for us. And as I say, it's something therefore that we could cultivate. And it felt, like I mentioned before, a lot like it came through. It wasn't that I brought it in, it was that it was there, and for some reason it was able to come through fully at that moment. And that's sort of maybe when we start to analyze the times we've fallen in love, we maybe get that sense too. I know I did, that when I start to think about the relationship I have where I fell in love, it was more like love came from within and came out. It wasn't like it came to me from the other person. The other person maybe triggered it, but it certainly came from me, and I just, you know, the drawbridge was down and I kind of just let it come through. So Santosha, this, you know, is really asking us, I believe, and I know not everyone talks about Santosha this way. Sometimes people just talk about it as acceptance, but I personally believe that it asks us to cultivate this idea of falling in love with every moment, of allowing that love that is to come through as much as we can. And there's a real gentleness to it. So I had this vision earlier in the year, which I sort of wanted to share. So I was driving what's called the FDR, which is like a six-lane highway on the edge of Manhattan. And it goes all the way up the east side to the Bronx. And I'd moved to Brooklyn, so I'd come over one of the bridges and driving up the FDR. And it goes alongside the East River, and you pass the Brooklyn Bridge and Manhattan Bridge and Williamsburg Bridge, and then you go all the way up. So it's very beautiful because you're driving with the river on one side, and then you've got Brooklyn to the other side of the East River, and it's fairly low rise, Brooklyn, and there are some lovely parks along the river that you can see. And then on your left, because I was going north, you've got like the skyscrapers of Manhattan that you imagine, and you can all just see concrete as far as you can go. And it's sort of, it's raised, the FDR as well, so you kind of like driving in the thick of the concrete. And I noticed like the birds, I must have been in heavy traffic, I guess, noticing the birds coming along the river. And I knew that peregrine falcons nested in the Brooklyn Bridge and the Manhattan Bridge in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And I noticed some birds sort of coming across the FDR and going into like the metropolis, like into the concrete, and off they went. And I could see like one of the birds went to a tree that happened to be on a rooftop. And when I lived in Manhattan for 11 years, I was always be amazed at how nature just suddenly found a way in the midst of all this concrete, you know, like the weed coming through the pavement or the tree root that was cracking through the concrete sidewalk. And I remember one day I noticed on my balcony there were two goldfinches, which was just like amazing for me. And the way I saw this when I was in the car was that it was like love and the mind, where the mind was the city and the concrete and nature was love. That it was very gentle, but always trying to get in, always gently coming in and finding a crack where it could and setting up home and then, you know, building a little family or a nest in there and gradually expanding, but ever so gently. You know, it's not like we just woke up one day and there were like, you know, 40 kangaroos and 30 armadillos and, you know, beehives and whatever going on in the city. Like, it was just gentle things you wouldn't ordinarily notice. And that's how I feel, or that's certainly the vision I had then about what happens with the mind, that the heart is always sort of goes on for miles and miles and miles and miles. We can't even imagine where it's spirit, if you want to call it spirit instead. And it's always just finding the cracks and getting in. And so this sort of very gradual process of this like falling in love comes through, of just sort of chipping away and letting the heart open slowly and slowly, and decreasing the mind and gradually overtaking it like a little jungle, but over years and years and years, or maybe lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes. But it's a really beautiful process of falling in love. There's nothing to rush. And that's the other thing I think about Santosha, is like, it's just a very, it's an active practice, but it's also very, very gentle. And that's the whole point, like, of, you know, Deborah Adele saying that this Chinese proverb of, you know, people in the West always like getting ready for something. And Santosha is very much like just accepting where you are now and allowing that to come through just moment by moment, or not, and that's okay. And this constant acceptance, but opening to falling in love. So one of the final practices that I wanted to mention, and this is sort of stepping away from Eastern wisdom, I mean, kind of, not really, but a little bit, is how to live a life that knows only love. Why am I blanking on his name? Jay is here, and if you're here, can you just remind me the author's name? It's it will come back to me anyway. So the beautiful book that is How to Live a Life That Knows Only Love has this lovely practice in it called the Loving All Method. And this, I feel, is absolutely perfect for Santosha. And it says it can be summed up as follows. Michael Langford, thank you, Kathy. As love everything you perceive exactly as it is. Love everything you experience exactly the way it is. So I'm just going to read part of this practice because I just love it. And it's pages and pages, so I won't go on. But anyway, it says, love every thought you have exactly as it is. Love those thoughts you think are good exactly the way they are. Love those thoughts you think are bad exactly the way they are. Love all your emotions exactly the way they are. If you feel happy, love your happiness exactly the way it is. If you feel sad, love your sadness exactly the way it is. If you feel courage, love your courage exactly the way it is. If you feel fear, love your fear exactly the way it is. If you feel love, love your feeling of love exactly the way it is. If you feel anger, love your feeling of anger exactly the way it is. Love your body exactly the way it is. Love the objects you see exactly as they are. Love the people you see just the way they are. Love your actions just as they are. Love everything you feel, think, say or do exactly the way it is. Love everything you see, taste, touch, smell, or hear exactly the way it is. Love everything other people do, feel, think, or say exactly the way it is. If someone says something nice to you, love what the person says exactly the way it is. If someone says something mean to you, love what the person says exactly the way it is. If someone says to you, you're the nicest person I've ever met, love what the person said exactly the way they said it. If someone says to you, you're the most disgusting person I've ever met, love what the person said exactly the way they said it. If something nice happens during your day, love it exactly the way it is. If something horrible happens during your day, love it exactly the way it is. And finally, love everything that happens just the way it is. Love every activity exactly the way it is. Love every experience exactly the way it is. Love everything exactly the way it is. Practice this loving all method during all your waking hours, from the time you wake up in the morning until the time you go to sleep at night. Practice the loving all method. And I just love this. And he mentions in it that there is like a process, because it might be a hard leap. And he mentions that you can start with just saying, I emotionally allow everything the way it is. And then you can begin emotionally accept everything the way it is before you move to love. So it's interesting that Michael Langford also sort of sees there to be like a path of acceptance, allowance, or allowance, then acceptance, and then this practicing of love. Yeah, if you, as Kathy says, if you can't love straight off, you know, you're still being authentic. Just emotionally allowing exactly the way it is, or emotionally allowing, not emotionally allowing whatever's happening. And he says that nothing really, there are no changes that you need to make in your behavior. So he says if a vase falls, you would normally try and catch it. Still try and catch it. You don't allow the vase to fall because you love, you do not allow the vase to fall because you love the falling. You can love the falling and you can also love the attempt at catching the vase. And if someone were to punch you in the face, you would normally duck. You will also duck while practicing this method. Loving the fact that someone is trying to punch you does not mean you will not duck. You also love ducking to avoid being punched. So I just love this. The loving all method does include emotional acceptance. It's not about changing your actions. But the more you practice, the more skill you gain. And I really do believe this, that we can just sit here, and I mentioned this last week, and just pull up roots of things that we want to let go of, and we can take that root, but we can also start to sow seeds and help ourselves out by having a practice. So, you know, you wake up tired and you can ask yourself, what would love do? You would love that feeling. And if your train is late, you could ask yourself, what would love do? And in the Bhagavad Gita, we've talked about this before, Swami Sachidananda says, you can just ask yourself in those moments, what would peace have me do? How do I regain my peace? What is more important, this frustration that my train is late, or to have peace in my heart? And then you're actively making the choice. And in that choice you make, there is a purification that takes place that allows love to come through. So that's kind of where we're getting back to this, you know, the practice does allow for purification and allows love to come through. It's not like you're actively bringing it in or forcing anything. What you're doing is stepping out of your way slightly. And while, yes, it's about accepting in the moment where you are and seeing if you can just allow everything to be, at the same time, there is a practice you can have that practice is an unwinding, that it is an accepting in itself. And Jay has said here that there are 10 audios on every chapter of this beautiful book, How to Live a Life That Knows Only Love, in his study group, and they've just finished. So, Jay, are those audios, they are online, are they still? And people can find them on the Awakening Together website. Yes, they can. And I'm going to ask you now, Jay, as I've got you here, I looked and I couldn't find them. So how exactly do we find them? Of which heading are they under? Is it obviously under audios? Then do you remember the subheading? Sanctuary groups. Okay. Do you remember the sanctuary group? Sorry. No. Cheryl, I'm asking Jay where his recordings are, not mine, the Michael Langford group. Okay, so you can find them at Awakening Together, audios, sanctuary groups, Michael Langford group, all the audios on every chapter. And the chapter on Loving All Method is chapter 9, if you wanted to skip ahead. But I do recommend you read the rest of it because it has beautiful quotes that actually sort of, in my mind, do open you up to this idea of loving all. And it sort of feels like a purification of while you're reading it. So I think that's all. I forgot the most beautiful part of Santosha. So every yama niyama has a promise of what the practice brings as sort of incentive. And what is beautiful about Santosha is the promise is that it will bring you a life of joy. So one well worth doing and cultivating. And it also, you know, it always feels good when we make moves to recognize the sacred, practice gratitude, find the love that underlies the anger or grievance that we have, and also just to practice loving being punched even while we duck. I look forward to being with you next week. And we'll be looking at willpower, tapas. And this year is actually the year of the fire rooster in the Chinese New Year, but for the pagans, it's the year of the phoenix. And tapas is about sort of reducing ourselves to ashes and arising from that as a phoenix. So I'm looking forward to that next week. But in the meantime, I'm going to play a little bit of music just to end, and wish you a content and joyful week, and namaste, and let me see if I can get this song on.
I will dive into each moment.